Okay, this is back to Free Radio and Coral Reef, and I'm ready to start the interview. I don't know if John's ready, but John Carney has arrived in the studio. And what I'd like to introduce John is by saying he's worked continuously in the film and television industry since graduating from the San Francisco Art Institute in 1979 with a Master's of Fine Art degree in film. His work experience includes big-budget feature films and smaller personal films and documentaries. He has photographed his own productions on video and 16mm film. He was a co-producer of War Dogs, which is one of the more popular shows to be featured on the Discovery Channel. John is co-writer and second unit director of the Iron Lodge, a feature documentary. He also wrote and directed a 12-part series for teaching English as a second language. In the world of big-time studio films, John was the lighting director of The Perfect Storm, which is one of the most challenging visual effects projects of the day. Welcome, John Carney. And talk right into the microphone-y. Yeah. How long have you been around here?
I was born in Santa Cruz, so I've been in and out of Santa Cruz much of my life. After high school, a couple of years after high school, I moved out of Santa Cruz, went into the military, and was away for a while. So off and on for, you know, many years, you know, probably 50, almost 60 years.
Off and on for 60 years. Yeah. That means that you must have been here 60 years, huh? Yeah. Then when did you move here?
I was born in Santa Cruz, actually.
I'm sorry. I
was born in Santa Cruz and actually not too far from where we are.
Wow.
And so I'm familiar with this neighborhood, although it's changed a little bit. Away for different, you know, periods of my life, away to pursue career, away for school, lived in Colorado for a long time, had a business in Colorado with some friends, and lived in San Francisco and lived in the East Bay while I was going to the San Francisco Art Institute, and was there for about almost 6 years, and then lived there after I graduated. I stayed up there for an additional year. Back to Santa Cruz for about a year, and then to Los Angeles. And I lived in Los Angeles for about 15 years.
Oh, wow.
And part of the time I was in Los Angeles, I would return to Santa Cruz because I had family and friends in Santa Cruz, and I'd want to come and visit. Yeah, I miss Santa Cruz a lot.
That was really exciting to read that you helped on the movie, the lighting part of A Perfect Storm. I saw that movie. I can imagine how to figure out how to get that to work, you know, how to make all those tons of waves.
I gotta say that the biggest challenge was the water, and half of that set was water, you know, most of the time. So we learned a lot. You had to follow a lot of safety regulations and just be really aware of a lot of for myself, since I was in the lighting department, of all the safety components that go along with working with electricity around deep moving water. So that was a real challenge. But we had a great crew and a lot of support. And, you know, I thought that it worked really well and it looked great, too. People were really. It won an Academy Award for best special effects of that year.
Oh yes,
as I remember.
How long did it take to make that?
The pre-production was probably longer than the production. The production was quite lengthy. It was probably 13, maybe 15 weeks. And then in the last third of the movie, there was a second unit that was going in doing an 8 to 10 hour shift right behind the first unit, picking up a lot of the second unit and some of the visual effects shots. So it was pretty challenging that way. The thing about a big film is, one, there's sort of a comfort zone with a big film generally comes with a big budget, but the bigger the film is, the more challenging it is technically. The more components, the more elements involved, also opens the door for more things that may go wrong. So it was one of those challenges where I got to say, not many of the crew, at least in the lighting and grip and camera, they were always looking after their equipment, and it was very detail intensive, equipment intensive, and you just had to stay alert and stay on your toes for safety. And working around water, very dangerous. And we were lucky, minimal minor accidents on that show. It did happen, but it was well coordinated. Everybody, was very professional, and big challenge, and I was really proud of it that I got to work on something that size. It's certainly the biggest thing that I'd ever gotten to do in my life.
Yeah. That was made on the East Coast, wasn't it?
Part of it was shot live at Gloucester, Massachusetts. Had to do that. That's where the story took place. But probably two-thirds of it was shot a stage 16 at Warner Brothers in Burbank, the big stage on that lot. Because it's not only the tallest stage on that studio, but it has a 20-foot deep pool, so they had to remove the stage floor and fill the pool up for the sake of the film.
And they had that huge last wave of the whole movie.
Yeah.
Was that on stage 16 too?
Part of it was on stage 16. The boat part was on stage 16, and at that time, we had the largest blue screen, live blue screen stage that anyone had attempted. So we had about 275 feet or more, almost 300 feet of blue screen that went almost 50 feet high. The ceiling of that stage was 60 feet, so we went about 50 feet high with the blue screen out of the water, and surrounded us about 270 degrees, so it was quite challenging. What you saw from the boat's point of view and looking at the boat going into the wave was the real boat that we photographed on the stage against the blue screen, and then ILM in their technicians, artists, visual effects artists, put that wave in. It was really fascinating. The process, the whole creative and technical process, was very fascinating. We began the show with a series of meetings. It was very necessary because it was so technically challenging, where we'd be shown storyboards that were made of just stick figures.
Yeah.
And with every subsequent meeting, the stick figures would be replaced one, with a photograph or a drawing that was penciled in. And then the drawings, the next version of those drawings would be more elaborate. Once we kind of settled down to a look, and this was all up, to the, for the director's approval. Wolfgang Petersen was the director of that. So, of course, he had a real strong vision and a lot to say in the direction, the production design, the visual design, and what he wanted to see in there. So we just had an immense, little army of artists and technicians that were thrown at it to create that show. And now, of course, since that time, there have been a lot more challenging and elaborate visual effects shows that turned out very well too, but it was for the time. It was the biggest blue screen that anyone had worked on and made work, and so it was pretty fascinating to watch that whole process, and then to be to participate the way I did with lighting and some of my lighting ideas, and I got to work with the best people involved, the best technicians. You had access to that kind of a budget. If we thought that we wanted to try something that maybe hadn't been tried before, but would look like it might serve a show of this size, with all those challenges, that's you know, 90% of the show was wet, or 80% of the show was in the water or under the water. So we, you know, we got to try out a lot of equipment, and we did very well. We very, very few accidents or failures, equipment failures, really accidents. If somebody was just being careless and might have tripped or something like that, but nothing serious, no one seriously hurt, or, you know, none of that happened. And it was to the credit of the crew and everyone being, trying to be alert and everything.
Did you learn to scuba dive, or do you do that?
I do that, and I didn't scuba dive on this show, but I learned to scuba dive several, probably 25, 30 years ago, because I had a lot of friends that did that as a sport, and I wanted to go and dive with them. But I worked on a film, a Hollywood film, Tom Cruise film called The Firm, and there was some underwater work in that, so I got to do some of the underwater lighting for that, and I went back and got my certification, my card, so I could take equipment under the water to light for that, because I wanted to do that and was very excited about that. And the bonus on that one was we got to go into the Caribbean and the, you know, the Cayman Islands to light that. So that was another incentive to learn and get certified to go down.
That's wonderful. I heard somebody say Cayman Islands. Nobody mentions it. They say it once, and that's where they're hiding the money, and they never mention it again.
Yeah, it's funny. I went into this building. It was the Bank of Cayman or something like that, and it wasn't an impressive-looking building. In fact, it wasn't very large, or I guess I expected some large marble, giant, impressive, you know, imposing building, but it wasn't that at all. It was a little building, series of cubicles, with names of all these world banks there, and telephone lines and a computer. And I asked the guy that from the Cayman side, and I said, "What's with this? I thought all these banks had big vaults here or something." And he said, "No, that's all they got." So I don't know. Gives you an idea what's really going on.
That's all they got. Maybe we can do a documentary on this.
I don't know. Maybe we might talk about it later.
Underwater. No. But what have you done since the firm? See, was that after the perfect storm?
That was before the perfect storm. That was probably two or three years before the perfect storm. And I couldn't have worked on the perfect storm unless I had worked on the firm, because the same camera and lighting and grip crew, many of the same, went on the perfect storm. So it was because I had known those people and I'd worked with them that I had that opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Which was more enjoyable crew to work with, or are they like interchangeable? Some of them went to the probably worked on the firm with you, huh?
I guess I've had pretty good luck throughout my technical career. I seem to remember the good memories, but I haven't had really, you know, had any bad experiences with working on a, you know, with a big crew and a big show. There's something that happens though on a long show. There's a fatigue factor that hits everybody, and even the you know, the most grounded people are going to be affected at some point. You're just wore out. Your schedule, sometimes the schedule bounces. It's not a regular, you know, predictable schedule where you're up at 6 and, you know, working at 7, coming home at 5 or 6. You might come in at noon one day, come home at midnight, or you might go for a week of all nights when, you know, you go in 8 or 9 and come out at, you know, at 6 in the morning. So, and that on a long show, it's hard to catch up on your rest. And what I've seen a lot is just people that are affected that way by fatigue factor. And it's, you know, it's one of the things that comes with that, you know, with doing that in that career. So
never quite get never get caught up with that. No. Well, you have quite a few films under your belt.
I remember when I was just leaving school that it was so hard for a long time. You know, some of our a handful of the people that were ahead of us in school would, you know, they would come back and say, oh, you know, I got to work on a big film, or went to Hollywood, or went to New York and worked on a big film and stuff. But it was just really hard, and the reality, and I don't know if it's true for everybody, but for most of the people that I know that have gone to film school, is you got to work on a lot of independent stuff for a while, and then gradually you know the people that are really motivated, really talented, and you're gonna get called back, you're gonna get hired, yeah, on something, and everybody who's made a success in the film industry, they were people that, you know, that was their destiny. They were planning to make a career out of it, and they were talented and devoted to it, and you know, did a lot of long hours on something small or an independent show with little or no money to get those opportunities to move up on a bigger show, and, you know, maybe join the union, you know, and turn it into your career. So and that was kind of the first the letdown after school. It was, oh, where are we going to go? We just learned all this cool stuff. But you gotta put some time in first before anything happens. At least I did, and most of my friends, I have to say, you know, that's how it was.
Uh-huh. What other ones that you did that you want to talk about? Okay.
Oh.
Read them off.
Yeah.
Some ones I liked that. Oh, wow. Field of Dreams. Edward Scissorhands.
Yeah, and Field of Dreams, that was something. Again, it's pretty popular. I see that on Encore. It comes around a lot, and that was for me it was special because I was able to work with a crew that I had worked on a lot of projects with. So after a while, if you're between jobs or away from a group of people, you come back, it's like coming into a family. So Field of Dreams was at the time the biggest thing that I'd ever worked on. It was done for Universal, many of the people that I'd worked on, but a lot of television stuff in Hollywood, were with that crew, the director of photography, art director, the gaffer, the key grip, a lot of the makeup folks, prop people. We were all able to work together, and that kind of lasted for about 5 years, and then there was a point where people, you know, started working on other projects with other crews. But that was interesting. A lot of stuff happened. It was a time, we were in the middle of Iowa. It was a time of when they had suffered a terrible drought. And the whole state was concerned that their produce, their corn, their wheat, they weren't going to be able to make their crops, make their money, and it was really kind of depressed. So in the area where we landed, in the central part of Iowa, we were, you know, buying supplies every day and going to restaurants and stuff and just contributing to the local economy, which is a very, very big deal. People really like that. And, you know, they even wrote about our crew in the paper and said that they were going to miss us because we actually helped this group of people survive one of their leanest summers.
Really?
You know, this, as another sideline, at that time, the state of Iowa brought in a Navajo medicine man to pray for rain for them, because they were so rain starved and afraid of losing all their crops, and But we just happened to be very lucky on our show. We filmed our baseball field, giant baseball field, in a location that had a spring. So we were able to pull water from that spring to put on our field, you know, our field of dreams, which was that giant cornfield that you see in the movie. And again, it was nice because you're working with just all really talented people. After a while, you get so used to working with the same people that you kind of, I call it a shorthand way of communication, where you can just kind of look at people because you know them so well, and they know what you need or what you want, or they can do the same to you, and you get it. Okay, you just get it. You can kind of nod at each other and go and pull something for them, help them out. And that was always something that I thought was pretty remarkable. But it's not unusual, I guess, for you know, the same group of people that spend a lot of hours together to do that.
Oh, yeah. And they had to stay in Iowa, huh? And they didn't. They thought that was the best place to make that movie.
That's what Iowa was, where the story took place, and I think the director had a lot to say about that. Phil Robinson was the director. He was at Universal at that time, and he wanted to shoot it where it took place. And I think he was right. It just wouldn't have been the same if we were, you know, trying to do it in Hollywood or Southern California. You had to go there. I think that the show and everybody kind of feeds off that energy and the vibe that's there, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, I grew up in the Midwest, and a bunch of cornfields for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Usually, you know. Then we have Edward Scissorhands, which would have been quite a challenge, huh?
Yeah, again, that's a Tim Burton film. And it was one of those things where, for a while, I worked on about three or four Tim Burton films, again, with the same crew. And it was one of those things where when he would start a film, he would start, you know, his producer would start making calls, and the same people would be, the same key people would be called, and then, you know, bring their crew. So it was neat because, again, it was like a big extended family you'd go and see, and maybe you hadn't seen people for several months, and people had gone through changes, and so it's always fun to do that. And again, it helps because you're a tight crew. You can get things done. You can, you know, you work very efficiently. And I think that the director, I know, appreciates that when there's not a lot of chaos or people wandering around, scratching their heads, wondering what they're supposed to be doing. I think it helps the director, the actors, and, you know, all the people get their job done, so you're not distracting any of those people.
You had self-control, and everyone respected the director, and that helps. Just wanted to know. Get done. So I noticed you also brought some art books.
I did, because we were talking about photography the other night, and mm-hmm. I wanted to bring you a sample of some of the work that I've done. I began in photography, photojournalism, fine art photography, and it was while I was attending school at the San Francisco Art Institute that I began taking film, and then I eventually graduated from there in film. And I took as many film and photography courses as I could.
Yeah.
And we need a little, I guess we need to put a little camera in here, a little digi camera in here or something, so people on the computer can see what we're looking at.
I have to just try to use words to describe some of this. Look at this. This man's out in the middle. Looks like it's a... It could be the Midwest, and it could be around here, too.
Well,
looks like a scene from The Birds.
It is a scene from The Birds.
Is
but
it really?
Well, no, our birds. It's in the middle of Chesapeake Bay. It's an island in, you know, near Maryland, in the middle of the Chesapeake Bay. And we were working on a little film that was near a rookery. And this day, and part of the film involved the characters to go into this area, this rookery. And So anyway, whenever we get too close, all the birds would get very aggressive and let you know that you were there. We only had it for a limited amount of hours because, you know, the concern was you didn't want to upset the birds, agitate the birds. So we were there one day and got our work, but that was just such an opportunity to photograph my friend running away from the birds like that.
Yeah, that's quite, tells a lot. It's like they are, coming down to earth or something. The birds look like they are UFOs almost. No, they look like birds, though.
Yeah, and you got that they were very concerned about people encroaching in their nesting area, because in the grass behind that man, there's all kinds of nests and eggs and stuff. So you know there was an area we couldn't go in there. We had like the custodians or the docents that were with us always to make sure that we stayed out of their way. But every once in a while, the birds just would get, hey, you know, we gotta chase these guys out of here. So we had
kind of seabirds are they? They're not.
I don't know if what they are officially. They look like a seagull to me, but you're right. They're another kind of seabird. I don't know what that would be.
Uh-huh. Oh, I like this. It's just a page of dried up ground.
Yeah.
Crack.
Yeah, and again, it's one of those nature abstract prints that I saw and would go for, and it's one of the things that when I see something like that, I'll generally look at it for a long time and take a photograph of it, because I'll see something and I'm not even sure what it is I see, only that there's something that resonates out of it for me. And I like the fact that oftentimes these things can become so abstract you're not really sure what they are, and whenever that happens, I aspire to that. What that is a it's a mud field in Anza Borrego Desert in the southern part of the state, down by San Diego, east of San Diego.
You have a whole book of these, and have you used them in other ways? Have you touched them up and done anything different, made posters?
Only showing them in a gallery show recently, like a coffee shop gallery. San Francisco coffee shop gallery as well. So small boutique galleries. I've been in a couple of group shows with my work as well. And it looks like I'm going to be showing a series of photographs at Main Street Realty.
Say that right into the mic. Main Street.
At Main Street Realty. The owners of Main Street Realty are big local art supporters. And every 2 or 3 months, they have a rotating art show with different artists. So I'm going to have an opportunity to show there, which is fun because a lot of my friends in the South County could come and visit and, you know, and look at my work on the wall.
Yeah. Would that be part of these?
I'm
sure.
I have others that are already framed, but the show is not complete yet. So some of these will be displayed on the wall as well, and then also some color work, which I didn't bring because all my color work is framed at home right now.
Wow. I love black and whites too.
I love black and white too. I'm very, very, very excited and stimulated by black and white.
And do you like mostly nature?
I do a lot of nature, but I also do a lot of people. Nature because it's accessible. You know, I have a cactus garden behind my house, so, and cactus to me is like land coral. It's just all over the place, so I love that when it gets to show itself. People, whenever I get to attend an event, and I'm always looking for a photo opportunity, so, you know, something maybe a little different or something I can bring home and remember the event by. Of course, I've done a lot with the custom cars and the motorcycles.
Oh, yeah, I wanted to get to the part.
But it's kind of whatever might inspire me. You know, I try to, make sure I have a camera close always, and you just don't know, and that's the beauty of this art form. You just you don't know when something's going to call out to you, hey, I'm here, you know, and it might be something as simple as something that you've looked at, you know, every day, you know, for a long time, but suddenly the light changed or the clouds passed over the sun or something is different about it. There's a little haze in the air and it gives it a spectral quality. And when that breaks through and that happens, I just love those moments. So I try to, you know, hopefully be open to that. And a lot of that comes from my study and the influence of people that, you know, that I admire and study and have learned from over the years.
Who would those be? They?
Well, I went to the San Francisco Art Institute and we studied, I got to study with Perkle Jones, Jerry Burchard, were in the photography department. I took a couple of classes with John Collier, and John Collier wrote a book, a very famous and a very, very helpful book called Visual Anthropology, about a process of photographing, mostly photographing people, but photographing stories.
Oh, wow. Really, John, how do you do that?
Well, you spend
you mean like storyboard, you think?
It's kind of like I would have to say it would be like a storyboard in your mind, kind of a process that you might go through to come to that place.
Mm-hmm.
And it's his class was great because you're expected to have already mastered a lot of the technical so that you could come and, you know, jump into the more creative, expressive. And one of the things that I can remember John Collier telling us was, if you come upon something or a group or an individual, you'll probably get some kind of hit or blast of energy there, and that's the place where you start. You go there. You try to find what is it about this event, this person, this group, or whatever it is, this old derelict building, this junk car. There's something about it that's calling you. And sometimes it takes taking a lot of pictures. Sometimes it takes careful observation. But after a while, if you come into it, not just to come in and to get a shot to record what you're seeing and get out, but to really spend time to try to let it talk to you and get to know it, you might have that opportunity to maybe take that level of photograph that's a real keeper. That's, you know, it's more than just taking a nice picture. So, and he had his book outlines a lot of this, and a lot mm-hmm. of it comes down to just being open, being aware, and letting feelings come in, and how to, through your training and through your study, how to try to find ways to capture that feeling in a graphic form.
And you have to learn how to look at things differently. Is that from, you learn that taking art classes?
Well, I guess you do, but it's one of those things that I found was, it's easy to sort of listen to and learn about, but it's difficult to practice, to do it well. It takes a lot of practice. It takes, for a photographer, taking a lot of pictures. If you're a filmmaker, taking a lot of film or video and telling a lot of stories, I think. On the other hand, there's some very gifted people that just seem to get it, and they always amaze me. So I kind of feel that I'm still on that learning curve, but I have the benefit of taking all the past years of learning with me and putting them into practice differently, you know, each day with, something new that I might see.
You've taken quite a nice assortment of pictures here. You want to talk about the car shows?
Yeah. Now,
beginning of
the car. This is a photograph. Again, we need our little, you know, digi cam or something to share. But it's a photograph of one of the car shows at Beach Street, the Beach Street Revival. I grew up in Santa Cruz, and many, many of my friends were, as soon as we were 16, you know, everybody had a car that they dragged home into their garage and would work on it and try to raise money to work in, you know, little part-time jobs, get money to paint the car and just do what you could with it, lower the car, paint the car, you know, put a bigger motor in it. It was a way to express yourself, and it was what you were kind of driven to do. And it became a real, lifestyle and cultural thing, especially since many of the same friends that I know today, like 40 years after high school, are still doing cars and still doing motorcycles. And only they've learned a lot more, and they're doing it differently and on a different level. But it's just really, for me, it's really fascinating to see that some of the guys in high school that I knew that were interested in street rods and fixing them up and cruising them, you know, around with their friends and racing when you weren't supposed to race, all that stuff. They're still doing it. At least building the cars, you know. I mean, they're not putting themselves at risk at all.
When you know people that build the elite cars that no one would spend all that money on, except maybe, what's his name?
Yeah. Well, you find it's a real expensive hobby. So, yeah. One, you got to be really dedicated to it. You got to have a lot of expendable cash, and I don't know anybody in this climate who can do that. But there's a few people that continually buy cars and, you know, high end
Jay
custom
Leno,
cars.
I think I agree.
Yeah, look at his collection. He's got a great collection, and he bought. I'm not sure. He bought a Mike Leeds car. Mike Leeds is a local Santa Cruz car builder. I'm not sure which one he bought, but I know that he has bought cars in Santa Cruz, and I think he bought one of the Mike Leeds cars. And Mike Leeds he's been building cars and wild motorcycles for as long as I've ever known him, and I guess I've known of him for 25 years, 30 years. He's an artist, car builder, and, you know, just one of those really amazing, talented people mm-hmm. that we have. And every once in a while, someone will build that real special car and put it in a car show, and, you know, someone will come along that just loves that car. You know, it could be like this 37 we're looking at, or a 40 Ford Coupe, or, you know, just whatever their favorite car is. And now that, you know, those cars are rare now. They're not as plentiful as they were, you know, a long time ago. So, you know, if you're looking for something like that and it's the right car, it's been taken care of, you know, it might encourage someone to throw some money down at it and take it home. So.
And they want photos of it too, I'm sure.
Yeah, it's kind of it's interesting because a lot of the times my photographs will be of isolating some detail in the car, and it's one of the things that I've experienced with looking at the cars is it's a combination of a lot of things that give this car this look and or this attitude, or there's something about it, one of these cars that people have put a lot of time in. And I'll go out of my way to kind of look and see beyond the overall hit that you get from looking back at the car, the whole car. There's little subtle things that they'll do that gave it that look that might be a little different from the car that's parked next to it. And I'll look for those things, and I'll try to photograph those things in a very, I guess, expressive, novel way.
Such as on this angle here.
Exactly. And
there's a couple of them I saw.
Yeah, exactly. The thing is, most of the car owners, they kind of get impatient with me because they'll like my photographs, but they'll go, well, where's the car? I want to see the whole car. And a lot of reason for that is so many of these car shows are outside, middle of summer, sun's beating down, reflections all over the place, so it's kind of hard to, you know, unless you have a little bit of cloud cover, a little bit of diffusion, it's hard to do that full-on car photograph without getting a lot of those reflections and kicks and things that are annoying. So that's another practical thing too, but I try to like train myself to find, you know, these really exciting graphic elements that kind of tell the story of what this car is all about. And people go out of they've made choices when on what kind of components to put on these cars, you know, what if they're mixing parts or headlights, taillights, chrome, you know, a bit of a fender hood or something from another car. They're doing it for a reason. Give it a little longer line or lower line. And when you're looking at it up close, you might not really appreciate it. But then when you stand back and watch it, it kind of gives the impression, you know, with that kind of, you know, energy that the person, you know, saw and felt when they were building it. So I try to capture some of that, you know.
That takes a good eye. Thank you. Know-how and, you know, experience viewing a lot of things in life and knowing what to look for.
Yeah, and it's, I just, I just feel that it's kind of, you know, part of my responsibility. With one of the reasons why I'm here is to be able to do stuff like that. And maybe, you know, like you and I or a group of people, we might go to the beach one day and maybe we'll have our cameras. We'll all be taking pictures. But I bet that we're all going to be going off and doing our own pictures at some point. And that's I like that. And then when we come back and look at all our photos, a lot of times we'll have one of those moments of, where'd you see that? I didn't see that. But there's something that you saw, you know, that called out to you. And I love when that stuff happens. I just, that's part of the creative process and, you know, being aware and excited and appreciating life and looking for these things to come at you. So I think that that's, you know, when you can do it, I think it's very fulfilling. And that when you can share it after and other people can share in what you saw or felt, then, you know, that's part of the equivalency theory that Minor and Giles, you know, and Stieglitz, you know, talked about.
Yeah, your friend Giles was on this program about a month ago.
I wish I would have listened to it.
Janaea interviewed him.
Uh-huh. Oh, good. Yeah.
Yeah, he brought another man, a younger person. Uh-huh. I don't remember.
Uh-huh. Well, he's someone I'm so lucky. We're lucky because we have him. He's with us, and he still presents his work in galleries and shows. So we have opportunity to see his work. But I consider him someone on his level, just to be a national art treasure with his combined knowledge and the level of work that he puts out. And it's we're seeing less and less of that. You know, large format black and white photography is, you know, is going to go away when companies stop supporting it. You know, the big film and, you know, labs and start supporting large format photography. But it's going to be with us for a while yet. It's not over yet.
When the art form of having black and whites is no longer regarded an art form, just like in a passe thing, or
I hope that it becomes more of an art form because it'll be more precious and valuable.
Industries wouldn't support it because of the money then?
All the money was in digital technology and supporting digital technology. So, you know, when you're a big corporation, like we're seeing examples of that every day in the news, you know, you look for areas that are underproducing, you know, and just, you know, not turning the money over like they were. Just imagine the 50s and 60s what black and white was doing, you know, right before color. And then black and white still held its own, you know, as an art medium before, you know, or during the, you know, when color was taken off and people were experimenting with different kind of films and solutions and printing formats. But black and white still held its own, you know, until very recently. And it's sad, but I don't think it's going to go away completely. There's enough people that are so passionate about it, and the collector base is real strong too, that supports fine art black and white.
Yeah, I know that you support it quite a bit.
Absolutely.
What are you doing presently with when you take your camera? Do you do as much?
I have a small collection of some vintage 35mm cameras and medium format cameras, and my cameras, I treat them like someone would treat a, you know, a collector car or something, but I run film through them. I'm just not going to leave them on the shelf. I'll put film through them and learn how to use them and take them out and photograph, because at one time, maybe in the 40s and 50s, those cameras were used a lot and produced a lot of just, you know, iconic photographs, you know, over the years, you know, with different photographers. Yeah. So I kind of hope and believe that I'm channeling some of their creative endeavors through the old technology and somehow to improve my work and my eye. I also began learning digital photography and bought a, you know, pretty high-end digital camera. And this year my wife bought me a new lens, telephoto lens.
That made a difference,
A big difference, because I went to Laguna Seca, the the Le Mans class car races, and I didn't quite have a long enough lens to get the photos I wanted. So she was very nice and gifted me with a telephoto lens. Pretty, you know, high-end, expensive one, too. So that was fun. Made a big difference in my work.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that. Thanks, Ismana. I might mention that you worked with Ismana on a couple of documentaries. I'm probably not even aware of all of them, but I was reading about Burning Men, Hot Shots.
Chief Mountain Hot Shots is one of the Native American series that Ismana produced, and I helped her direct all four of them that she did. And the Chief Mountain Hot Shots is about an all-Indian wildfire fighting crew from Montana, Blackfeet tribe in Montana. And how that came about was probably 10 years ago now. There were a series of wildfires in Florida. And there was an NPR story about the firefighting crews that were fighting, helping Florida put out their fires. And they interviewed an all Native American firefighting crew that was from Montana. And it was the Chief Mountain Hot Shots. And it just struck me. Ismana listened to the same program we talked about later that evening. You know, how the state of Florida had to go all the way to Montana to get a firefighting crew in there to help them out. But they were not just the Chief Mountain Hot Shots. There were firefighting crews from all over the country who were helping them. And they were interviewed, and in their interview they talked about, why they thought that they were there and what they thought they could do to help with the firefighting and all the high level of training that they go through. Well, Ismana is very, very native sensitive, culturally sensitive, and just saw that as an opportunity to tell their story. And that's literally where it began. She went on the website, got some information. She made some phone calls and got herself an introduction and went up there and went to the elders of the tribe, went to the firefighting officers of the tribe, and offered them tobacco and told them that she was impressed with what they do and wanted to make a story about them. That's how that story began. And we worked with them for almost 2 years. We went to a couple of fires with them, and of course we were always escorted by someone in the fire team, and we're only given limited access whenever something looked like it may turn into something threatening. Then we were put into a truck and shifted out of there and had to leave, which was fine and understanding, but it was exciting. And Ismana is one of these producers where she's good at looking into the story behind the story, and in her story about the Chief Mountain Hot Shots, she was able to go into their whole tradition back to the Plains days and their tradition with fire. And we all learned a great deal, about, well, this tribe, Blackfeet, Northern Montana tribe, and a lot of Native American tribes, how they use fire to hunt, corral buffalo, how there was a fire keeper, a runner, whose only job was to run with hot coals to the various outlanding tribes to ensure that their fires were going. And it was so important that for the survival of the people that he could lose his life if he didn't do this successfully. So we got to listen to all these great stories and talk to the elders, and it was very fascinating. And she did an incredible job telling the story, of which she always does, because she's just really great. I think a great documentary filmmaker and storyteller. One of the many things that she does well.
And how many cameras were used on this production? Oh. It was really successful, I know.
We went out about four or five different times over about a two-year period. And we shot with a 16 millimeter film camera. And there were different times we probably used three different video cameras, and sometimes it was just with what was available, what we could afford to take, and we couldn't afford to take the big high-end digital camera that we like. So, you know, we had to take something smaller and you just work extra hard to be sure that we could get the coverage that we needed on a high enough level to, you know, to later in post-production that would match the technical level of a higher end camera. But you know, when you're shooting on a budget like that, a little or no budget, it's I don't think it should be a hindrance. You do the most and the best that you can with the tools you're given. And also, I've had a lot of experience, so I can help her make decisions on that. And the people that we always brought in were again, you know, very skilled and had a lot of technical experience. So, you know, like it's, for instance, if you're shooting in bright sunlight and that's the only shot you get because you're talking to people that are working and they don't have time to sit and, you know, go into a protected studio environment to give you an interview, you got to shoot, you know, you shoot with what's given to you. But there's ways to help you to get the best, you know, kind of coverage and exposure and all of that. So you learn how to make a lower end camera, you know, work as well as it can so that the extremes of the sun and the shadow and the contrast aren't, you know, really going to, you know, are going to cause less harm to the overall look of the show. And sometimes you just kind of got to go with what you're given. If there's no light, something's going on, there's just a big fire, but you have a chance to get some little bit of footage that tells a story, you got to go in there and do the best you can. So I always try to tell people, well, you know, do what you can. Try to, you know, try to put some money together and get the best equipment you can. But now with a lot of the consumer equipment is so powerful that, you know, you can do a lot. You know, do a lot with a little. It's very affordable. And then I think it's just, you're just limited by your imagination.
And is this film available right now?
16 millimeter film?
I mean, is the Hot Shot.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Chief Mountain Hot Shots, I didn't.
Yes, through Ismana's website, Tara Lucida website. And she has a distributor, and right now I can't think of who the distributor is, but I could get you that information. But her DVD, video and DVD are available. And she's always had a couple of distributors. In fact, you can search her titles on Amazon, and you know, you can even order through Amazon too. For some reason, she's done better with a couple of the independent distributors, and most of those distributors end up distributing to Native American customers, but not always. A lot of educational institutions. She's made sales to a lot of schools, a lot of educational institutions. So she does pretty well with her work.
Mm-hmm. And you've assisted her a lot, and
quite a bit. Yeah, most all of her productions, film or help her direct, and you know what. Because I've had more of a background in a lot of the production end of it, she doesn't need to be bothered to learn another part of it when she's got the passion and the, you know, the opportunity to tell a great story. So, and she's also she's a good producer in the sense of, you know, she brings good skilled technical people around, and again, a lot of the same people that she's worked with before, that know how to overcome the problems, the technical problems, so she doesn't have to worry about it. She can, you know, rely on them, and she can just work with, you know, creating the kind of story that she wants to tell. And that's always exciting to watch.
I'm really happy to meet someone that knows how to handle, such as yourself, all the technical aspects of creating art. And
yeah,
it's been a real thrill to have you on here today.
Okay.
John Carney has been giving an account of his history and his life as a photographer and filmmaker.
Thank you very much.
I hope we'll hear more about you and from you.
Yeah, I hope so. Bring back more stories and share more work as well. That'd be good. Look forward to that.
Yeah. Thanks again, John. And what else would you like to say as a last thought? You don't have to be.
Okay, I think that art, I think photography, filmmaking is a very high calling, and I think that if you are at all motivated and inspired to do that, I encourage you all to do it. I think you may not realize it, but whatever stories you have to tell, they're all important, and they may not be important today or tomorrow, or you know, the distributor might, you know, not get it, but if it comes from the heart, I think it's going to be important down the road someday. You know, so yeah, you know, try to put whatever resources you can, call your friends, and you know, get out there. It's important. And it's important, especially now, that the stories that we tell, you know, aren't all dictated from big corporate media. You know, we want to make sure that the stories come in, you know, from the people that are in the trenches trying to dig themselves out with their friends and their families. So I think those stories are important too.
Good advice, John Carney, thoughtful person and very smart here on Free Radio, Santa Cruz. And thanks for listening to Cosmos and Cruzmos. We'll have new ideas next week with Janaea, and I'll be back in 2 weeks. So thanks for listening, and tune in.
Let's go. Pero también algo está pasando ahí en carpintería, ¿no? Something about indigenous struggle también, ¿no?
www.imemc.org for Thursday, February 19th, 2009. Israeli jet fighters bombard Gaza while troops injure a Palestinian man in the West Bank. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Hours after the Israeli cabinet declined to enter a truce with the Gaza-based resistant factions, Israeli tanks rolled into eastern Gaza City and opened heavy random fire on Palestinian residents in southern Rafah City. The Al-Qassam Brigades, armed wings of the ruling Hamas party in Gaza, said in a statement emailed to media outlets that the Al-Qassam fighters defended against Israeli tanks' advancement into the eastern part of Gaza City. No casualties were reported. Thursday morning, Israeli tanks opened heavy random fire on Palestinian residences in Rafah City in the southern Gaza Strip. Witnesses said that tanks stationed near the Kerem Shalom crossing opened fire abruptly in the area. No casualties were reported. Earlier on Thursday, Israeli media sources reported that an Israeli army unit on the southern Gaza-Israel border wounded and arrested a Palestinian man who was suspected of attempting to plant an explosive device near the Kerem Shalom crossing. Palestinian sources reported later in the day that Israeli jet fighters bombarded areas along the Egyptian border. Sources from the Israeli army alleged that the attack targeted underground tunnels at the borders. Palestinian sources reported no injuries. The army spokesperson added that the attack was in response to the firing of homemade shells launched from Gaza at nearby Israeli areas. One Palestinian man was injured and another kidnapped during an Israeli military home search campaign in the southern West Bank city of Hebron on Thursday. Local sources said that Israeli troops searched and ransacked a number of homes in Hebron City, the nearby Al-Arub refugee camp, and a number of villages close by. Medical sources stated that Jawad Khairan, 37, sustained moderate wounds during the home searches. Meanwhile, one man from Hebron was kidnapped during the morning attack. Seven Palestinian civilians have been kidnapped by the Israeli military during pre-dawn invasion on Thursday, targeting the northern West Bank city of Nablus and nearby village of Asira al-Shamaliya. Thank you for joining us from Occupied Bethlehem. You have been listening to Palestine Today from the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org. This report has been brought to you by Ghassan Badnoura and George Shmawi.
Free Speech Radio News.
Welcome
for Thursday,
February 19,
2008,
Middle East
in Washington,
Center,
D.C. I'm Leanne Caldwell. President Obama travels to Canada. Leaders talk about Afghanistan as one nation plans to remove troops while the other plans to add.
Israeli jet fighters bombard Gaza while troops injure a Palestinian man in the West Bank. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned.
And finally, another installment.
Hours after the Israeli cabinet declined to enter a truce with the Gaza-based resistance factions, Israeli tanks rolled into eastern Gaza City and opened heavy random fire on Palestinian residents in southern Rafah City. The Al-Qassam Brigades, armed wings of the...
This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, February 19, 2008. In Washington, D.C., I'm Leanne Caldwell. President Obama travels to Canada. Leaders talk about Afghanistan as one nation plans to remove troops while the other plans to add. In Pakistan's Swat Valley, reaction to the peace deal between the Taliban and a religious cleric.